Hello, welcome to Therapy Talks. I'm Chris Place and I'm a psychotherapist. In this podcast series, I'll be chatting with different people about their experiences, their lives, their loves, their challenges, and what helps them find their way forward in the world. I'll also chat to different therapists and researchers about the models of therapy that they use to get a better understanding of these different approaches and how these different approaches might be useful at different times for different people. Hopefully there'll be lots of human connection and conversation about the challenges we have and also about what helps us get through. I hope it's going to be fun, enjoyable, entertaining, engaging, informative. Anyway, let's go on the journey. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Therapy Talks. I am delighted. I have to say, I'm really delighted to be joined by Lisa Berry. Lisa is a yoga teacher, a yoga trainer, has been practicing yoga for about 15 years consistently and then teaching for the last 10 years. She's involved in yoga in the Galway scene, teaches in NUI Galway, teaches an elective module in the university. She's involved in, she's a thing called Textures of Yoga in Coffee Works. So we're going to talk about all of these things. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So I'm just going to get started because I'm quite excited. Lisa, how are you?
I'm good and I'm delighted to be here. So thank you for
having me. Yeah, no, thank you. It was a chance meeting in a coffee shop, Callie in Salt Hill. I was wandering in just before I was jumping into the sea with my friend Tom. Started talking and then discovered that you were his yoga teacher and it went from there.
Yeah, yeah. The best kind of meetings.
The best kind of meetings, yeah. Not planned. And you kindly agreed to do this. So thank you. And just before I hit record, we talked about some really fascinating things. So I want to kind of try and talk about them again, if possible. You mentioned pre-recording that you teach yoga probably for the last 10 years, but that you've done work with Cree and you working in the university as well in an elective module. So I was particularly interested in those two things, having just family experience of Cree and having worked in the nursing and teaching psychology. So I'm just really interested in both of those things. What was Cree like?
Oh, well, the facilities are amazing, to be honest, and what they do. Yeah. And they try to do it, I think, as no cost to the participants, the clients, the patients, I don't know how they class them. So to have that facility and all those staff on hand, it was ideal for me because they handpicked the patients for me. It was a pilot that I was running. It was a service project. It was over 30 plus hours. And I linked in with the nurse, I think she's called Link West, Maeve, she's called. Also the head of programming, Lisa Hines, and Breach, who works there. On reception, she also teaches some of the exercise classes. So these students were identified already. I got a little bit of a background, not really enough to kind of prepare me to what came in, but enough for me to know how I wanted to hold the space. That changed immediately when they came in. There was a group of 10, mainly male. There were three women, and from the age of 30 to mid-70s. And all had, obviously, cardiovascular health in common. In very recent recovery, some of them from surgery. And with different abilities and different experience, and some had never done yoga before. And so that was interesting in itself. And they came, I think, with an expectation that we were going to come in and go onto a mat and do a few exercises and really not much more. And it was a lot more than that. So bringing in the mind, the body, the breath, which was really important and something that they hadn't really worked with before, or they hadn't utilized their own capacity before or thought about it in that way. And then physically, I broke it down into elements they could relate to. Like the first one was strength for your muscles and your bones. But all in that first workshop, which I kind of taught it as a workshop, was a physical element, but it was breath for strength as well. And also meditation and getting used to the idea of silence, because we fill every spare moment of our time. And I think we come, depending on your age, you can come from that generation where you feel guilty if you're not doing something with your time. You know, it's very hard to just sit down and give yourself a moment where you're thinking, I should be doing this, I should be doing that. So I kind of had that demographic in there as well. So I started each week was a grounding practice, and it was more about awareness than anything else. Just what are they bringing with them into this room today from their night's sleep, from whatever has been going on, you know, emotionally and mentally. And then how does the physical body feel? And then where are you breathing? And even that's a big thing for someone to think about. What do you mean, where am I breathing? I just breathe. So I get them to feel in their body, where do you feel your breath? And then take the breath from there. And what was lovely about Cree was that we put into each workshop a tea break. So after 1 hour, they went off, they left the room, and they connected, they bonded, they all had something in common, and they all had their own story to tell each other.
And there's a real healing in that, though, isn't there? Like, for people who've had these significant health experiences to come together, and there's such a sort of community support in that,
totally.
Seems to me.
And over tea and biscuits, you know, which is, you know, just
absolutely
something very simple. And they come back
and
their energy was totally different, you know. And I think, and all of them was like 2 hours. Oh my gosh, like, how am I going to do the 2 hours? You know, and for each of them, it just flew. And one lady at the end of the first one, and she said to me, I don't think I'm good enough to be here. What do you mean? I don't want to hold anybody back. Do you think I just shouldn't come? I should try something else. And I said, absolutely not. You know, I said, you did really well. Everything that you did really well. And she said, well, I'm so pleased because I really enjoyed it, especially the cup of tea and the chat. And this was a lady whose husband had died 10 years previous and has struggled at every single thing she tried to do. Nothing engaged and nothing had an effect on her. And this was the first time she was a dog, did a, was a dog had been really ill, or and she was struggling even leaving the house. I think they had to really coax her to come. And at the end of it, she said every single week she looked forward to coming. And
that's transformative.
Yeah, she
then,
did things
isn't
she...
It?
And even I did this exercise that I do in my gentle yoga, where without them really knowing it, it helps you how to use your body in a different way to how help you get up off the ground, because we use our hands for everything, to push down on the chair to get up, to walk up and down the stairs. It's just, we just pull ourselves and push ourselves. So getting used to where we're so cut off from our lower half of our body because of sit a lot, and it's very hard to put breath down there. So a lot of the work that I do, especially in the strengthening, not just the flexibility, the strengthening, is get them to use their legs. And it's a big thing that's not really thought about or talked about, we're just on autopilot a lot of the time. But she dropped something out of the fridge and she thought, what am I going to do? Because I can't get down to pick it up. And then she said, I remembered. You showed us how to do this. And this was a huge thing. And she bent down, she picked up whatever came out the fridge, and she was able to get herself up with her own body weight, not by dragging herself with her hands. And she couldn't wait to come in to tell me. It was such a big thing. Well, it is a big thing.
There's so many questions I have. Like, I mean, I'm finding myself, as I'm listening to you, noticing my own body. I'm being very aware of my breath. I'm suddenly going, oh, right, yeah. And noticing that I have a tendency to kind of use my upper shoulders and hear more and forget about these legs and this power. And I suppose, in a way, yoga is about a reminder of our bodies on a deep level. Is it? Would that be a way of saying, I mean, yoga is so much more. It's a spiritual practice. But
Well, I like to see, and it's kind of, it's not counterintuitive because it's the same thing. Like, our work is very similar in different ways, but it's about bringing people out of their heads back into their bodies.
Yeah.
You know, and we can be so scattered and we lose that connection. And so usually even just this grounding with your feet, like, where do you hold weight, you know, and how people stand, and they're the most simplest things that have the most transformative results.
You can be so conditioned. I can only speak for myself, but I'm so conditioned sometimes to hold in a certain way and to be very much in my head, or and physically to be very much there. So those moments of connecting to my feet, or, you know, to my breath, they are transformative.
Yeah, they are. And even if you can do this sitting, you know, with your feet on the ground, you can do this through your sitting bones. And mm-hmm. I try to teach, even when we're, say, on our mat on our hands and knees, that you can ground through your hips. You've got to hug in. So a lot of what I'm teaching is not, we spill out all the time and we splay out everything. Mm-hmm. And it's about just bringing it back in and just coming back mm-hmm. to, I don't, it's an overused word, to our center, but finding out what our center is and where our center is. And mm-hmm. Physically, because it's the most tangible thing that we can relate to. And I think that's why yoga works, because you can just feel it. Mm-hmm. You start to feel it. You start to feel stronger and more flexible. But then the more you practice yoga, you start to feel it emotionally and mentally. And then that's when you start to step back and think, oh my God, what's happening here? Because the physical mm-hmm. part, we can, like when we run or we go for a swim or we lift weights, we can feel that and we know we're doing some good because we can see it as well. But it's when it gets a little bit deeper, and the breath mm-hmm. is the way into that as well. You know, instead of just walking mm-hmm. around, just knowing we breathe and that's all we know.
So it moves away from that mechanistic kind of, you know, kind of purely physical, you know, it's not just about building muscle.
If I didn't teach the breath and the mindfulness or the meditation, if I didn't teach that, then I'd be teaching an exercise class. I'm not saying there is a place for that, but that's not what I do. And because I know how the rest or the physical practice is such a small part of yoga, but this is how we come into it. And then...
Yeah, in the West, and in my life, like I've always known, like yoga for me was downward dog, the cat, the warrior pose. I learned, depending on what I'd done, hatha yoga, and I kind of knew the poses, and I, you know, would bring you into your body more. But I'm really interested, I suppose, in, because I often think that's where East and West meet in terms of psychotherapy and yoga, is the, when you talk about mindfulness and the breath, and moving into something deeper.
Yeah.
It moves away from purely a physical exercise into something.
Well, it's like the body, you'll only get so far. You can't, that's it. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it's the same with the mind if you're not going to connect it to the body. Mm-hmm. You know, it can only get so far. You know, and you know, with trauma, and I know that's your area as well. And when they bring it back to animals, you know, that shaking off mm-hmm. that, you know, and we have it like our tribal, you know, still there's tribes out there and they still have those practices and rituals where they'll shake and they'll dance, they'll scream, they'll sing. And it's a way of moving emotion, trauma or whatever out of your body. And we kind of move so far away from that, you know.
Yeah. It's funny, as you were talking, and just before you said that, I was looking back to your beautiful dog on the couch mm-hmm. and he's there, and he just, as you were talking, I saw him, his whole, he moved, but it was the way he moved. And it's like animals do that, you know, that they just have this way, as do babies. We have a 6-month-old baby at home, and I was watching him this morning, and he was in bed. He's gone in his own room now, so I spent a lot of time watching the monitor, just going, oh God. And but I was watching him, his whole body and being was involved in what he was doing. Do you know? And something happens as we get a bit older. We seem to...
We all started there. We, don't we? You know, well, I suppose it starts in the schools where you're told to sit and don't move. You know, so we have that put off on the upper and the lower body. But it also starts with... And nearly everything that we do is like a survival thing, a protection thing. It's just that we carry mm-hmm. it. We don't let go of it. We carry it into our adult life. So I have a teacher called Max Strom. And he has a book called A Life Worth Breathing. And I've done a lot of training with him in person in real life. And he talks about it in a really clear way. And he says, when as children, when we get to that stage where we realize there's consequences to our behavior, We just start to, it's that we protect our heart, we start to round a little bit. And you'll see this with young, but you see that in adulthood. So as you start to round, your breath, because you notice the baby and children, they breathe in their belly, they stand with their palms open and they just play and everything's amazing and everything's new and everything's open. So the front body's completely open. And it gets to that when children realize there's consequences and they go to school, you know, there's playground behavior and stuff. They tend to start to kind of roll in and they round the shoulders and then the palms turn backwards. And if you walk behind people, when I was learning this at the beginning, just walking the pram or walking on the street and looking how people walk, and it's this natural stance where the palms are facing back and it's still this protection, but it's what happens to the breath. The breath begins to move up. And it becomes more shallow. Instead of this belly breathing and the diaphragm, it comes up here and it stays up there. And unfortunately, we bring this into our adult life. And that's when we get anxious and it's the shallow breathing. But we tend to breathe with our secondary respiratory muscles and not our primary. And that comes from that childhood, that transition into realizing that, oh my God, these consequences to if I say something, what could happen? And if I do something, there's a consequence to it.
It's amazing because you, in a way, you're talking to me. If I can, so there's a Carl Rogers is a psychologist who kind of talked about conditions of worth and this idea that, you know, I have this innate self that is to be who I am in the world, and it's like my self actualizing, just to be fully myself. But I also need love, and I need these things. And then sometimes my need for love is so strong that sometimes what happens is I get, it's conditional though. You know, I love you if you're good. I love you if you're quiet. I love you if you're a good boy or a good girl or whatever. And then bit by bit we go, all right, I need, my love is conditional. So I have to sort of, and then as you describe it, it becomes a physical thing. And I think a lot of these theories didn't, even though they talked about the body and they talked about the full self, the practice isn't always, so when I hear you talking about it, I can just imagine how yoga could facilitate a meeting of our self-actualizing tendency.
Yeah. You know. And even the most simple movement as turning your palms forward. It's not like you need to walk with your shoulders back, chest up, you don't. It's as simple, turn your palms forward. You get this opening across the chest and the collarbones widen just a little bit. And then you'll know how that affects you. Your posture affects you. You know, your self-confidence.
It's amazing. I'm conscious that we've sort of almost started. Okay, I want to go back a little bit. Like, so you didn't always do yoga.
No. I started as a legal secretary for many years.
Okay, wow.
But I wanted to, and I've done a lot of public sector. In the UK, I would have worked in the local government, administration, always kind of did that, but it was always to support travel. I travelled a lot. So my dad was from Kerry, North Kerry, Ballyhyke. He left as his age did around 16, and he came to the UK and went down to southern England working on the farms, and then he ended up in the north of England where I'm from. He was there for a while, and his sister was there, and he then went to Australia. And it was in Australia that my dad had an accident, and he lost his sight and he lost his lower arms. So he came to the UK because his sister was a nurse there. He didn't want to come back to Ireland. He didn't want anyone to see him. So he came back, and he was a sheep shearer. And when I have the cutouts from the newspapers in Queensland, and he came back with they raised all this money for him, and he came back with one of his friends, and they paid for him to come back with him. So he came to Accrington in Lancashire, where my aunt was living, and they were living together. And as far as my aunt knew, this was the rest of her life. She was going to be caring for her brother. And then his mom came over for a while to the UK, and she died there. And then my mother was my aunt's hairdresser. And my mum and dad met over the telephone. And so I have two brothers, and there was a big difference in my mum and dad's age. It was 17 years, but my dad never saw my mum and he never saw his children. But I grew up with stories of cattle ranching.
Yeah, of course. So your dad was blind at that point.
When he came
blind
back to England, yeah, when they used to walk
yeah
there. So
blind.
he was 32. So for 32 years, he had sight and he had quite, I think,
Wow.
quite a wild life from all accounts.
Yeah.
And then my mum was 24 when she had me. So, and yeah, so there's kind of another whole story there. And then my aunt then got this opportunity. So my aunt has lived in New York since I was 1 year old. So she's now in her late 80s. So I'm in touch with her a lot. And pre-pandemic, I would have gone to visit her maybe once a year. So I always had travel. It was such a big thing. It was an adventure. It was something my dad had done. And so from the age of 21, I've traveled. Well, from the age of 18 as well. But 21 was kind of me traveling by myself. And then my husband, John, I was 23 then. He was 27. We did like maybe 10 years of pure travel where we come back intermittently, do a little bit of work, save up, and then we just go traveling. And mainly Asia. We lived in Australia and Hong Kong, and we lived and worked in the States, and we traveled to India and Nepal, and we just did this for.
That sounds amazing. So you would come back to England then work, save up money, and then
And I'd
travel.
always, now to be honest, like I always believe that whatever job you're doing, just always leave on a good note. And I always do your very best. Cause it's easy because you leave and you just go, oh, I'm just going. It doesn't matter. And I'd literally, we'd fly back in the day after, go to say hello, and I was starting work the next day. You know, so
Wow.
we both were really lucky. We're never out of work. And then we came to Galway as just somewhere else to save up. We were working and living in Chicago, and my brother, now his wife, was living with his girlfriend, and she was from Mayo but had been living in Galway. And so we said, oh, we go to Dublin and then to Galway. And we had 2 nights in Dublin, 2 nights in Galway. We just thought, oh my God, it's not even a contest. I don't know.
So you said you'd stay in Galway for a little while,
Yeah,
or?
As everybody says, 6 months.
Yeah, I was just saying, it's like, I'll stay here for a few
Yeah,
months.
and then, but things, see, the way we traveled, it was always very much, don't always think the grass is greener. If we like it, we stay. And if we don't, we just move on. You know, we had that, always had that freedom, because we were just traveling with backpacks. And so we kind of applied that mindset to being here in Galway, and we both got work straight away. We made friends without effort, and we found a really lovely apartment without effort. I don't know what it'd be like now. I'm trying to do that, but it was just seamless.
And were you at that point, had you discovered yoga?
No. Nope.
Okay.
Well,
You,
I've
so
done
you
yoga
came to.
in the UK, and it was something I dipped in and out of, but it wasn't life transforming. It wasn't.
So it's like, you know, kind of, I'll do a few classes here, I'll do a 10 weeks here.
Yeah, it was nothing.
Do you know?
It was nothing major. And then we came here, and we were here 5 years. And we did travel, and we came back. But I was working in GMIT, and I was there maybe 8 years, but I had a particularly stressful job. And my mom died suddenly. Like, she had a brain hemorrhage. And
Okay.
she literally 3 weeks earlier turned 60.
So she was really young.
Well, yes, and her mother died at the age of 49 of the same thing, as a brain hemorrhage as well.
Okay.
And when my dad had died 5 years earlier, and I was at peace with my dad dying, like just our relationship. But when my mom died, it was very different. I felt like after my dad died, there was 17 years difference. I kind of had
Yeah.
this idea, but obviously it was my idea, not hers, that she'd have time for herself now. You know, like
Yeah.
my dad always worked. He worked as a telephone operator at the health authority. And my mom was a hairdresser, but my mom did everything. Like, she'd pick him up, she'd take him there, she'd pick him up at
Yeah.
lunchtime. Like, we always had holidays. We came to Ireland for holidays. We always had days out and stuff. But I just thought it was her time. And so we had this kind of resistance kind of relationship. And I get so upset because I just wanted her to look after herself. My mum was, she was a worker, and she was kind beyond kind, where she'd have nothing for herself. And so I had a lot of regret when she died.
That's really hard.
So I had all this kind of working up a job that was really not satisfying and really stressful. So yoga was, the hardest thing was getting to yoga, because I'd be at work and I'd look at all the work and I'd just think, I can't leave. And there'd be something saying, you've got to, you really have to. And I'd get myself to the yoga shala. And as soon as I got in there, I was, oh my, thank God, I left work.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And they were the only nights I slept after yoga. The only night.
Oh wow.
I
So,
just didn't sleep.
you were hyper stressed, like,
yeah, no,
with
and
the job.
I just take more on than I should. And I suppose I've always, I'd always kind of done that. I never really took easy jobs. Like I worked in housing benefits, and you know, like you'd be threatened on a daily basis. You know, I'm going to throw you through the roof.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, just a bit of daily threat, you know. So yoga then was hugely therapeutic for you, like hugely healing.
And it was literally the stress thing, and that's what it worked on. It was later it worked on the grief.
Yeah, it was later it worked on the grief.
It was a stress thing that helped me cope with stress. Definitely helped me sleep.
Okay.
So I just knew, oh my God, this is amazing. It was from the very first class. It's something. It was
Bingo, in yoga
the yoga
shala.
shala, and it was Christina Galvin.
Wow.
She was the teacher at the time, and then obviously Dave and Laura became my teachers. She left, but it was this one class, and it was just like I've been sucker punched. It was a wake up call, and I came out and I just went, "What happened? What just happened then?" And that was it.
So that was you were committed to yoga from then.
Yeah, I started doing one a week, and then it soon went to twice a week, and then a home practice. And my home practice was literally 7 minutes, because that's all the time I thought I had. It never occurred to me I could get up earlier. Didn't it? Just literally, I honestly, I've got 7 minutes. I knew what time I got up, I knew what time I had to go to work, so I had 7 minutes. So every day for 7 minutes, but 7 minutes changed my practice. I couldn't believe. I was like, so I'd look around the studio, and my head was like, oh my God, inches and inches away from the ground. I'd look at people with their head on, I'd be like, oh, I'll never be able to do this. But these 7 minutes every single day, I was just turning up a class, and my body was getting into positions I wasn't even trying to get into, because my mind was telling me you can't. And then my head was on the floor in, say, a wide-legged forward stance. And I was thinking, when did that happen? How did that happen? And that was 7 minutes.
It's amazing.
So I'm trying to
get. It's amazing when we talk about time. You know, it's like saying, I don't have time, I'm so busy. And yet we can make 7 minutes, 5 minutes, 6 minutes, 7 minutes can have a real profound effect.
And then it's a light bulb. Oh, I can get up earlier, you know, and then, you know, and then just changes.
So back then, your daily yoga practice was 7 minutes. What is it now? How does it look now?
Oh my gosh, because the asana is the last thing I do. That's all I did. So I get up.
The asana is the stretch.
Yeah.
Is the stretch.
So that's the last thing. That would have been the only thing I did. So now it's the last. So I have a Dinacharya, which is a daily practice that comes from Ayurveda. So it's all these cleansing practices where I scrape my tongue and I oil pull. Oil pull is like a non-negotiable thing. I put a tablespoon of sesame seed oil in my mouth and I swish it around for minimum 10, 20 minutes. But I do other things whilst I'm doing that.
Okay.
So,
and sesame seed
yes,
oil?
So cold pressed organic
sesame seed oil. And you take a spoon of that and
swish
you switch. Okay.
So it is known to also bring up, like detoxify your stomach as well, like bring up anything that hasn't been digested or anything that's hanging around there, but for your oral health, for your gums, for your teeth, for your breath.
Wow.
But I've been doing that for 10 years now.
So these are, I'm going to get the word wrong, and I've always got this word wrong.
Ayurveda.
Thank you. I'm not even going to attempt Ayurvedic. I've said Ayurveda. Ayurvedic. So that's Indian.
It means, it translates as life science, and the science of yoga, because they, as part of the therapies and the routines of Ayurveda, is yoga practice, the physical practice. They also have the breath practice. They also have meditation. But it's very plant-based. It's very medicinal, and how what I love about it, and one of the aspects and that I use, like, you don't put on your skin what you wouldn't take internally. So I only put on my skin organic extra virgin cold pressed oils, but oils that I would have in the kitchen. So and now there's all this science about, I'm very interested in my microbiome. So I eat to feed my microbiome. But now the science has said that your skin, it's directly affecting your microbiome. So you think all the chemicals we put on our skin, and you think whether it's a really expensive moisturizer that costs 30, 40, 60 euros. And you think about, well, anything that we just put on our skin is going into our microbiome.
Goes into our, so this is into
and
our
Ayurveda has always said that. That's what they've always believed. It's just different terminology. And another thing is intermittent fasting, which is a huge thing now. It's going to come up as...
it's becoming very popularized now, isn't it? That this intermittent fasting,
Ayurveda. I do a 16-8. So I do a 16-hour fast and an 8-hour window to eat.
Do you do that every day?
Every day.
So when how does so that would be like you start eating at midday?
I try to finish eating at 6 p.m.
6 p.m.
And then
okay.
It's only 10 the next day.
10 the next day. Okay.
It kind of changes. Now that's doing the 16-8. Intermittent fasting really is, Ayurveda would say, minimum 12 hours. So that's nothing. If you finish eating at 6, you know, you're naturally doing it when you're asleep.
So you just don't eat anything in the evening, and then you get up and you have a late, you don't eat it maybe first thing, but you'd eat at 9 or 10 or whatever.
Push it out now. At one time I couldn't, but my morning practice is first, so I start with all the cleansing practices, and then I sit. And to me, sitting just in silence is meditation. I think we can overcomplicate meditation, and it makes it something that's not quite reachable or attainable. So
it seems something that people who sit on mountaintops do, you know, or something that you need a what was it, transcendental meditation, you'd have to
a
have
mantra.
A mantra.
So literally sitting to me in stillness, and the work of yoga is to allow you to sit in the discomfort of what comes up. And that's the work. And as you know, that's the hard work. And that's why people struggle with meditation.
In psychotherapy, you know, there's a thing called psychological flexibility from acceptance commitment therapy. And they just talk about it sitting with discomfort. You know, so it's one of the things we as humans often will avoid, sitting with uncomfortable sensations, but actually sitting with, which is often could be painful emotion or sadness or anger or hurt or whatever it is, that we avoid these, we defend against these, we push these away. The more we can allow ourselves to bear sitting with them, rather than trying to, you know, do different things that can hurt us to get away from those feelings, the more we can allow ourselves to sit with these painful feelings, you know, and you're talking about that by sitting in silence.
And literally just call it sitting. Like, I sit and I do my pranayama, and pranayama, the breath practices, is one of the, they say, the easiest ways into meditation, because it brings you into that state.
So is pranayama using like breathing in a certain way?
There's numerous. That's one of them. Nadi Shodhana, alternate nostril breathing or single nostril breathing, which is amazing because it doesn't just affect your sinuses. It affects the hemispheres of the brain. It affects someone. Like when we inhale through the left, we're bringing in cool air. And when we exhale through with the right, we're bringing out warm air. And then if you're doing alternate nostril breathing, you're going to breathe back in through the right, bringing that warm air back in, and exhale through the left. But you can do single nostril breathing, and you can do it seasonal. So in winter, you could just have a right nostril practice. Just keep bringing in warm air.
You have to hold your left nostril
exactly,
closed.
So you'd breathe in through the right and you breathe out through the left. So you bring in warm air, take out cool air through the left. And then you just keep doing a circle, all in the same direction to warm you up. And then when you hold the breath, you're dispersing that warm breath into your cells, into the rest of your body.
So if I breathe in through my, and then hold.
Yeah, you're going to disperse that warm air. But then after every breathing practice, you have to sit in silence without fidgeting. And that's when the magic happens. Because if people do the breathing, then they want to get up and move on. And that's And you're going to feel different. Your nervous system has been affected by it. And then it's from there that sitting is can what can bring you into meditation. And it can bring you in like that.
Wow.
And
Wow.
that's only one practice. There's so many others. Max Strom would really, he'd really focus on Ujjayi breathing. And it's something I didn't use for grief. And after studying his work, I've kind of gone back to it. And the Ujjayi means victorious, and they call it ocean breath. And you're doing the full yogic breath. You're breathing from your lower belly up and out to the ribs, up into your upper chest. And then you reverse the breath. You breathe out from your chest, rib cage draws in, navel in towards the spine. And I get people to feel the body because you can expand. We forget we can breathe wide. Yeah, and we also need to breathe into the back body, our lungs. We breathe into the back of the lungs. We just tend to think it's at the front. Yeah, so it's a really nice practice to teach people to feel where their breath is. And most, and not all, is with the lips closed. So you breathe in and out through the nose. As you probably know, have you read James Nestor's book, Breathe or Breath?
No, I've heard of it,
Oh,
though. I haven't read
it's
it.
amazing.
Okay. And tell me about breathing in through the nose and rather and th- about the closed mouth, because that's often one that confuses certainly me and other people. You go, oh, I'm
well, it definitely it calms and quietens the mind as well as that. But we waste a lot of our energy out through our mouth. And then we have all this good bacteria as well, and that we need to keep really healthy, and we need our saliva. We dry out when we breathe through the mouth. That's why snoring, when you sleep with you. Because after you've read the book, James Nestor, you'll be putting sleep tape on your lips, tiny little amount. It's.
Will it stop snoring? Because that's a big bone of contention in my house at the
Yes,
moment.
I will. Yeah, honestly. And then you would, for this Ujjayi breathing, you tighten the throat, the muscles in the throat. And a really nice way to do that is to imagine, to visualize that your nostrils at the back of your throat. So then you're breathing into that place. So you're making a little bit of a sound like a wave. So you do that with the mouth closed, and that's Ujjayi breathing. And
You mentioned that for grief.
Well, he uses it for a lot of things, but grief will be one of them. But it's an easy breath to teach at the beginning when somebody's learning breath. And there's this kind of gentle, energizing quality to it. So then it's the silence, it's the sitting afterwards. So all the cells get oxygenized. Afterwards, it's not so. If you need to fidget, if you need to swallow, if you need to cough, you do it in the middle of the breathing practice. Then you sit.
So when you're sitting in silence.
Yeah.
That's it. Just sitting in silence. You're not even following your breath. You're not doing. You're just.
If
sitting.
The mind then gets a little bit active, and the mind can be a bully, and I teach that in yoga a lot. You know, listen to your body. You know, it's a feeling practice, because the mind is either going to say, oh, don't bother today. Just don't, you know, when you really, you could do with that. Or it's saying, right, push, come on, get, you know, and your body's thinking, oh my gosh, you know, you've got, we need to listen to your body. What is your body telling you? Not what your mind is telling you, you know? So it is that feeling practice, and it's awareness that you're cultivating when you practice each week, or you get a daily practice, you learn through your body.
If anyone could see this, I mean, this will be an audio podcast, but I should be paying you. Anyway, that's fabulous. I mean, the ideas, the things you're talking about, but I suppose for me, again, it's so experiential. Like, it's something that you just need to do.
Yeah.
Like, and then just to bring it back a bit, you run. So this is what your daily practice would look like. And then the asana is at the end, which is the movement, like the stretches and the thing that we often associate with yoga, which is obviously only one very small part of yoga. You teach yoga then, like obviously you teach, you've talked about Kri, you teach it, you teach a class, like a structured yoga class.
I teach during the week, during the day, on Mondays and Thursdays, I do a 1 hour gentle yoga, but I call it gentle yoga. It's a gentle vinyasa. It's a strengthening class, and
okay.
And I think as we age, because at one time it was like maybe retired teachers or retired, and now it's a mixture of ages. But regardless,
Where do you do that
I do that in
class, or where is
Anshom Yoga, so one hour.
that? Show me away.
But all
Okay,
that,
that's.
everything that I'm talking to you now is interwoven in every class that I teach.
So if I was to say, if I was to sign up to, if you were take, if do you sign up at the start of a term,
No,
or
no,
can you
no.
join
So
any time?
I do drop-ins, and I have a card which is 8 classes, and they don't expire.
Okay.
That's just, and I believe that you can't be late. So I know people, and I say this to my NUIG students: if you are running 5 minutes late, do not think then I can't go. You just come in quietly. This is your space.
Wow.
It's so
different, isn't it, to the normal way we structure things and the normal things we say, right? If you're late, don't, the idea you're taking all of those rules and sort of societal ideas about stuff, putting that out the door and just come,
Well, yeah,
just
it's
get
how
in and
you
come.
hold that space, and it's what I've experienced with teachers that I respect. You know, that
Yeah.
if I was going to be tutting and looking at what time people are coming in, the rest of the class are going to be doing the same. So if I can welcome
Yeah, it's all about
everybody,
judgment then, isn't
and if
it?
I can
Yeah.
welcome somebody in, and if somebody needs to lie there and not move, that's absolutely fine. If that's what they need more than anything else in the world, then I'll cover them up with a blanket.
Wow. That sounds amazing. So you do that. You do that twice a week, on Mondays and
Mondays and
Fridays,
Thursdays, and
in
then I teach
Mondays and Thursdays. Yeah.
a faster paced class, which I love, because it's a Friday at 6 p.m. And the way I think about it is, for those coming, sometimes you have to meet fire with fire. So it can be static heating practice, and it's about moving the week out of your body. Like, really get into that, so you can then go either into your Friday evening or into your weekend in a different space, physically, emotionally, mentally, that you've got it out. I suppose, like the animal shaking. Yeah. So, like, you
Sure,
come
sure.
expecting to move, but
And what you do that in the evening, do
that's
you, on a Friday
6 p.m. on
evening?
a
Is
Friday.
Friday,
And there's
okay.
always breath. There's always breath, and there's always, it's always awareness, always.
And how long are those classes typically then? Is it
That's 80 minutes, an hour and 20 minutes.
80, an hour and
Yeah.
20 minutes? Wow. Wow. And then you also teach in the
So
university.
I teach to students and staff,
Yeah.
and again, it's very, very much about getting them to really assess what are they bringing with them into, and I do a lot of grounding practices there because it's needed,
Yeah.
and getting them constantly. When I'm guiding people through, I have a sequence, I'm teaching it, but I'm also,
Yeah.
it's always kind of scattered. It's always, there's lots of questions for you to ask yourself. Where do I feel this? Where am I breathing? So I'm constantly asking them to ask themselves these questions, which kind of flips it on, because you can just go into class and just be led, and that's it, and then you walk out.
So you're getting them to actually really pay attention to themselves, to really deepen into their own process and become really aware, developing that self-awareness of what's happening in my body.
And then I may start with them, and just feeling the capacity for the breath, and I might go back to it before the end for them to feel again. And you can see them going like, oh my gosh, because we're moving to create space.
It's amazing. I've a few things going on in my head all at once, but there's something around, and I'm thinking about the work I do as a therapist, and sometimes really what we're doing is probably forms of yoga without calling it yoga, because a lot of the work is resourcing. So, somebody's traumatized, going into the trauma isn't really the best thing to do. What we do is we build resources. So the resources can be anything. Resources, it's what gives me ground. How do I feel my ground? And I'm just seeing that a yoga practice for somebody with trauma might be an amazing resource,
Yeah.
to bring those that as part of our treatment, if we call it that, is to develop a mindfulness yoga practice where I can feel safer in my body and feel held in my body, as opposed to being, when we're traumatized, it's almost like we're being attacked by our bodies, it can feel. It's like our bodies are going, ah! And if we can bit by bit create a space in our bodies where we can feel safe, that's really what we want to deal. That's how we deal, That's the goal, is to feel okay in my body.
And it is to empower them that they know they can do this for themselves.
Yes. And they can do it themselves. They can do it at home. Like that lady bending down and picking something on the floor. She could do that.
But the key to all that is awareness, that when you see and feel, should I say, when you feel those symptoms, or when you feel the breath getting quicker, when you feel it high up in the chest, then you can kind of, okay, right. You know, then can I bring my breath down into my belly, which is going to calm my nervous system down? And then it's from there you can respond and not react. And that's what I try to teach, that you're responsive, not reactive. And I go through the physical body and working through Tadasana, which is amazing. Now that
What's Tadasana?
Mountain pose. So you're just standing, but getting someone to it's also really smart, and it's you finding your hip distance. So your feet are underneath your hips. Yeah. So your bones are stacked on bone. You tend to splay out the feet to the side, which goes into your lower back, or the feet are a lot wider than the hips. So the pelvis has to work even harder to stabilize.
You bring your feet into your sort of like hip distance.
Well, you can measure this. You can measure this. So where you turn one foot in, so it touches the inner arch of the other foot. Okay. And then you press into that heel of the foot that's turned in, and
you're like, I'm doing this with my hands, but it's kind of like that.
Yeah. So say these 2 feet, you turn one foot into the inner arch of the other foot, press into the heel of that foot you've just turned in, and turn it back out. You've measured your unique measurement. That's your hip distance.
Yeah. Brilliant. Okay.
And it's the same way on hands and knees as well. Your hands, you can measure your shoulder distance with your hands exactly the same way, and it measures your collarbones and your shoulders. So your middle fingers are at touch, and then you turn your fingers forward. So I teach that at the start of every single class. You find...
Then if I bring that back, then that's my shoulder
distance. So you're being smart with... You're being efficient with your energy. And when your bones aren't stacked on top of bones, your muscles have to work so hard to hold them together. So we're just being efficient. So we're stacking bone on bone. So find your unique measurement for you, because it's different for everybody. And then from there, you build that. And then we start with the feet.
It's amazing. I feel like I'm having a yoga class right now. Do you know? And I think, you know, the thing I'm really struck by is your passion for this. Like you're, because there's something about, it's not just, it's something that it seems to come very deep from within. Like as you're talking about it to me, it feels that I'm really being, I'll give you a description. If ever I've been to over the years at different lectures, when somebody is so passionate and committed and connected to what they're talking about, you can be transported to somewhere else.
Yeah.
Whereas when somebody's kind of going through the motions and saying, and psychotherapy is blah, 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 it's like, it's kind of, you don't really connect. You just go through it. So when I'm hearing you talk, I'm hearing your passion, your sense of utter connection to what you do, and sense of engagement. I don't know, it just comes across.
I don't teach what I don't practice myself. That's a rule. And I learn it, and then I experience it, and I really work through it, and then I share it.
Yeah.
And so, I live it. And it's the same with Ayurveda, that shouts out to be lived. It's not just to be read and studied.
I remember. I think is it Deepak Chopra is the kind of big but I remember reading. I think it was his book Perfect Health or something. And but there was reading about Ayurveda. But I remember reading about it, going, "Oh right, that's fascinating." Just not doing it, and that's the piece, though, isn't it? We have to move it into the experience.
I know, but it is so interwoven into yoga. I mean, and there's still a lot of yoga practitioners who think it's, you know, who just don't live by those principles. But it just enriches my life to do them together.
Has yoga then, have you seen yoga being, I'm using the word westernized?
Commercialized?
Do you know, it's become something like, I don't know, you'd see different, I remember watching different, like there's different yogas, there's Bikram yoga, there's Ashtanga, there's Hatha, but that something is about like, we do this and we do, and it becomes quite I don't know.
Well, there's always been those lineages. So Hatha is the foundation of all physical yoga. But when you look in, when you study and you what we tend to work with the West is Patanjali's, the eight limbs of yoga. And the reason we practice physical yoga is so that our body can be comfortable enough to sit and meditate. Westerns, we can't sit down. Yeah, we took squatting out of our body vocabulary years and years ago. So we struggle sitting down. So the idea is that yoga is going to give your body, make it more open, stronger, so you can sit. So when you're working through Patanjali's eight limbs, you start with the yamas and niyamas. And these are like, you could call them guidelines. I call them healthy boundaries. So the yamas, there's five of them, and it's how you are in the world, how you are in community, how you treat the planet, each other. So the kind of, it's like a moral compass. And then the niyamas is how you are with yourself, how you treat yourself, how do you talk to yourself, you know? And so purity and like cleansing, sausha is purity, but it's not just, do I keep my body clean? Do I keep my thoughts clean? You know, and santosha, contentment. So not just, oh, this is fine. It's like, what I have is enough. And that's a practice in itself, enoughness, sufficiency. And then you move on to tapas, which is fire, which is passion, discipline, that you show up again and again and again, all those times you don't want to. And then Svadhyaya is your self-study, you know, that self-awareness. What happens when you show up again and again and again? And then it finishes with Ishvara Pranidhana, which is devotion or surrender. So in itself, that's a practice that's called Kriya Yoga, but that's part of the niyamas. After that, the third step is asana, which is our physical practice. So it's way down the eight limbs.
So the physical practice is, and again, as I've said, is what we typically know. Well, certainly what most people, when they talk about going to yoga, is they're going to a class where we're doing stretching and building strength. What you're saying is that piece is to enable all these other...
Because the one after that is pranayama, which is breath. If you can't sit still, you can't breathe. You can't practice these breathing practices. And then it's pratyahara, where you start to withdraw. So that's not even meditation yet. And there's kind of practices you can do that. You can do that when you're walking. You can do that in nature when you're swimming, you know. And then there's concentration, there's focused concentration. So there's meditation kind of tools. One is to stare at a flame, literally, to, you know. But they still say that pranayama, the breath, can be like this easiest route into meditation. And then after meditation is samadhi. Or moksha, it's liberation, it's freedom. It's where you just become one. But then you start again and again because it doesn't last.
This is, you know, when a lot of us will know about mindfulness, maybe through Buddhist practices, and they'll talk about, you know, mindfulness, and then people talk about, what was it?
Nirvana,
you know, that idea of kind of being liberated from the sense of self, or being connected to all as one, or whatever the name, you know, that enlightenment or trans. So all of these different Eastern practices, I suppose, there seems to be lots of overlap with them.
There is.
You know, and there's something then about, like, I'm always interested in, because obviously in the West, when we think about things very much from the mind, I suppose, has been the thing that's guide, you know, the idea that the mind was the thing that helped us create all these amazing things and do these amazing things and develop these amazing treatments and so on and so on. But that at the same time, we can't. I remember reading about different, my brain is going somewhere now, but there was a guy called Mike, a professor in the University of Plymouth, who was doing research on chronic fatigue syndrome. And what he was saying was that the body really and the mind are part of this complex organism that's trying to find balance all the time. And that when we get stuck out of balance, we're sort of stuck somewhere trying to find homeostasis, but that our reductionist models can't really figure that out. They're like, you know, that they're not very good at that kind of stuff. Whereas you're talking about stuff like that is very much about that. About balance.
And there's a teacher, you probably heard of him, called Jack Kornfield.
Yes,
he has a book called After the Ecstasy, the Laundry, because then reality comes in. You know, it's everything you might. The idea is, and as yoga kind of looks at it in the ancient yogis, is you get these moments of liberation, just moments, but that you're aware enough to feel them. But that we can get
but
them
then you
again,
come back to reality.
And then that's where your yamas and niyamas come in, because we're always going to be pulled offside, pulled off center, you know. So then these are this kind of these little teachings. Well, they're not little teachings, they're big healthy boundaries, you know, that kind of bring us back and can help us recenter. And then, like I say, that we are aware enough that we feel these moments of bliss, of joy. You know, we feel them. They're not just something that when I get this done, then that's going to happen. And when I do that, that's going to happen. You know, that we feel them in the here and now. And then that's the awareness, that's the yoga to me, is that I'm aware enough to be feel them as they're happening.
And there's something in there about that then can sustain us in the times when we're not feeling them. You know, like there's the times when we're dealing with the pain of life and loss, and but to have that peace that's, you know, like, yeah, like I suppose I have, you know, I coming from a psychotherapeutic tradition, think about different ideas or people who've written over the years about these places that we can meet in ourselves that we can sustain us. I mean, compassion-focused therapy, Paul Gilbert talks about that idea of cultivating a part of us that can hold us and support us through, you know, the challenges.
Because they're going to come, regardless.
Yeah, we can't avoid it.
We're meant to experience them. How then do we know the difference between sorrow and joy, you know, and that they can both live? You can't, see, we just want one of them.
I think there's often a tendency is I want to be happy. You know, I have to have happiness in my life. And so it's like, I can't have misery. I need to have happiness. And it's like, well, you don't get them. You don't get one without the other. You know,
and it's learning to let them happily live side by side.
You know? Yeah, and coexist. I can be sad and happy at the same time. I think about grief like that, actually. I've noticed with grief that you can be in like kind of, you know, wearing a cloak of grief, and then I could go swimming in the sea and come out and go, oh, I feel great, you know, and having those moments where I can look at my son and think he's amazing, he's incredible, and then feel really sad half an hour later. And it these things coexist.
But isn't that an amazing quality, this capacity as human beings that we have this? And that I remember walking up the Dublin Road in so much grief, and have these waves of grief, I just want to cry. Then I remember just having this amazing thought, and it just brought me so much joy. And I just thought, oh my God, in a split second, how that changed. Isn't that amazing?
I mean, I would see it in the therapy room again and again, where you see somebody coming in a way, and then, and it won't be anything particular I've done or anything. It's not. It's just a moment of witness, a connection, something shifts. And then there's this other kind of thing. And there's something you talked about with yoga, like, and certainly with the asanas, or even with working with people, say, with their breath, and, you know, working with people who've maybe felt their bodies in one way for so long can then feel something else and have a different experience. I don't know. It's amazing.
And I still kind of bring that back to awareness, you know, giving people the skills to, and any kind of practice, is to be more and more aware of their own bodies, their own breath, their own. And then when things come up, which they are always, and we just said, always going to come up. You know, I wouldn't have been known growing up for my patience. And now when people say to me, gosh, you're so patient. But I know I've learned that. And it's by putting little pauses in, making space for that, so I don't react. Because I had the consequences of reacting and things blowing up in my face, and then friendships, and oh my gosh, you know, and then just the turmoil that brings, and that not wanting to fill that empty space with something that could be hurtful either to them or to me. So it's that pause, and then learning how to then come back into my body to ground, you know, and then kind of you can kind of put yourself in somebody else's shoes. Or, you know, you become, I know I'm less judgmental than I used to. And I know it's because of these practices. Like, it has to be.
So that's the question I was going to have, like, for you, yoga in its in all of the aspects of yoga for you, they've changed your life.
Oh, 100%.
They've added, they've
enriched my life. I don't even think that it's some, it's not something I do anymore.
I guess you live yoga, like it is your life. It's not sort of, I'm doing yoga, like this is how I live.
Be in it, and it's, and there's such a huge body of work that it just excites me that hopefully I'm doing this for the rest of my life. You know, it's.
The existentialists have written about, you know, when we can find meaning for what we're going through, meaning for our suffering, having a purpose for our life, it makes everything more bearable. And so yoga for you, that whole experience of yoga. And have you found, like, dealing obviously with grief, with all the different challenges life has and life can throw at us, yoga has sustained you?
Oh, it has. It has. But it's also kind of I think you have to start with yourself. And that's why I like to share a lot of what I know has worked for me. You've got to start there. And that's what I say to the nurses as well. You can only give what you have. You know, if you don't give to yourself first, you're only giving a certain amount. You could probably give so much more care and so much, you know.
So we were saying that at the start, you teach a module actually in third year nursing. Like it's an elective module. And nurses do that who are third year nurses who have just come from their clinical work placement, practice.
And it is confrontational because I know for myself, and I speak to my sister-in-law about it, and she said to me, "But oh my God, that's really hard work." I went, "I know it is." She said, "I couldn't do that." I said, "Well, when you're ready, you will be able to do it." I said, "But it is hard, but it's so healthy. It's so rewarding." You know, and then so doing this work with the nursing, I'm kind of flipping it a lot onto them, asking them to feel this, asking them how they feel about this, and where do they feel this? So it's work they didn't expect to be doing on themselves. You know,
in academia, we tend the tendency is to be, you know, I teach in a psychotherapy training called TROCT, which is a biodynamic psychotherapy, so it's body psychotherapy. And it is the opposite to academia, and it's like looking inwards.
Yeah.
It's how I relate to you, how I relate to myself, and it's challenging.
Yeah,
you know, to do that and to sit with that, because it's like everything is about me now, and but you're talking about that as well. Instead of them looking outwards, saying how will I use yoga with my patients?
Yeah. I mean, we absolutely do that, but we start with them. So it's 2 hours.
They start with themselves. Start first. With themselves,
yeah. And then the second part of the practice, we turn it and we look at, and which is lovely, we look at increased mobility because a lot of them are working in care homes. And again, for them, it's like light bulb moments. Oh my God, I just didn't think there was anything they could do. And I do a whole chair yoga, pregnancy yoga, and also like respect for the elderly. You know, we look at respect and what that means. And it's just really wonderful. Powerful. I think it's really powerful just to see these students, what they come in with their kind of expectation, which is very little. it's an exercise class maybe with some breathing, and just to what they leave with. And I think it's and I love it when they come in then to the classes, you know, into the studio. It's great when
they continue on then. Yeah. They say, right, I want to.
And it's the same with NUIG. It's lovely. I have students now in the studio that would have started with me in NUIG. And
so I'm conscious of time, but you are if people were interested in signing up to your classes or joining, they could get in contact with you.
Oh yeah, through... so I have a website of lisaberryyoga.com. Yeah. I'm on Instagram as well, and then with the university and the socks box,
brilliant.
And then Coffee Working Press again, it's booked through my website.
And Coffee Working Press is a bit different. It's not a sauna.
No, it's a monthly workshop. It's a seated practice. Sometimes we stand, we always ground.
Yeah.
And I'm working through the pranavayus, which are the five of them, and the directions or movements of breath. And we're working with prana. And prana is about hugging in. It's this inward breath. You know, it's ingestion when you relate it to food, it's inspiration, and it's centered around the heart. So Usually then we do mudras, which are these ancient yogic gestures that you make with your hands. So each finger represents an element and the thumb is fire. And there's so much science behind this. It's like they're like train tracks. You know, when you pull a lever and the track moves and the train goes onto, it's like you diverting your energy to a different part of your body. And so we use those for the heart and the chakra. We'll do breathing practices for the heart.
And so just for people, that chakras then are the their centers
energy
within the body,
Yeah.
centers.
So again, you can think about this. The nadis are, think about them as roads. And these energy centers are like roundabouts. Yeah. So they keep traffic moving. They keep energy moving.
When I do meditation, or sometimes if I do mindfulness, one of the things I notice sometimes is I will feel like a movement here, like internally, but it's very real. And I'm like this. And I'm kind of going, I open my eyes and go, okay, no, I'm not moving. And it's like something's happening inside here. And I often wonder, like, I don't know. Anyway, that's
no,
just energy.
It is energy, but kind of pay a little bit more attention to it and just see, does anything else come up? Do you get a visual? Sometimes I get patterns. A kaleidoscope type of a thing. Sometimes it could be a
I sometimes find what happens is my body wants to start to move in a certain way. And like it wants to move out of the sort of sitting. It wants to start to, you know, do stuff.
Yeah.
Which is always interesting. This is fascinating. I'm sitting in a class going, be quiet, be still. But yeah, but I don't tend to be still. I have to allow myself to move. But I'm fascinated.
You have to allow yourself to move.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this has been an amazing conversation, and there's so many different places we could have gone. Like there's so many, we could talk for another 3 hours, I think, because it's just fascinating. I think I'm just struck by the sort of values, the values of what you're talking about, because there seems to be an awful lot of parallel for what the work I do as a psychotherapist, and hearing you talk about the work that it's very much traditions that are in many ways quite close together.
Yeah.
And maybe that could support each other in a way.
Oh, absolutely. I think so.
It's amazing. It's been brilliant.
I was going to say thank you. And to have this conversation.
It's been fabulous. It's been kind of, I just have, there's a lot of things happening for me at the moment, and I'm hoping that people can certainly enjoy it as much as I have had the conversation. I'm certainly going to start my yoga practice up again. I did do yoga for a long time. But again, when I say I did yoga, I did stretches in the morning for a long time, and then got out of habit. But I really would like to engage in a class again where I could really engage with the breath more as well. So you may be seeing me. Nothing on show.
I look forward
for.
To it. I do.
Yeah, no, genuinely, I think I could really, I'm going to. So you do it on a Monday?
Monday and Thursday, 10 o'clock.
Monday and Thursday. So Monday, I'm just working out my. And what times do you do them on?
So 10 o'clock for 1 hour, both days. And then
10 o'clock
6 p.m.
Hour.
On a Friday.
Great. Okay. I'm just going to work out my calendar. But look, it's been brilliant. I'm really grateful that I've got to have a chance to talk to you. Thanks for your honesty, your insight. I think people are going to get a lot of value from this. I certainly have anyway.
I really appreciate that you wanted to actually ask me some questions and to have this chat. And
it's been great. I mean, I had a lot of questions written in my phone, but I don't even know what they are now. But I think that basically everything you've said, it's just here. I think what I'm left with is there's so much to yoga, to the practice of yoga, that it, you know, to most of us are going to go, yeah, yoga, you just go and you do your stretches, but it's so much more than that. And I'm so curious about that, and that tradition of healing that we can, even if we don't take it, don't do everything, there's real value that we can incorporate into our lives.
And like the beginning when I said I did 7 minutes and it changed my practice. And then even when we come into yoga, it's through the body. Isn't that a wonderful way to come into it? And then how that's going to.
And then if I may find myself going further into it, then, you know, I often think it's a bit like counseling and psychotherapy. I come in to talk about a specific issue and then I go much deeper into the process. And suddenly I'm working on much deeper layers of experience that weren't the reason I came in the first place, you know, so it's a kind of process. It's been brilliant. Thank you so much, everybody. I will talk to you all next time. And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.